It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
But they and those interested in women's rights were very disappointed when the 15th Amendment guaranteed that the rights of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. It failed to mention voting rights for women.
Dr. Sandra Treadway, the Librarian of Virginia, speaks on the history of women's suffrage at the Library of Virginia on October 3rd, 2012. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how five big banks finally may be held accountable to improve service for struggling homeowners. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 183, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Banks that repeatedly ignored rules meant to improve service for struggling homeowners say they're on the verge of complying with standards ordered in a $25 billion settlement. After failing to adhere to at least two separate sets of servicing guidelines since 2010, five banks are preparing for more than 300 rules that take effect in October on loan modifications, fees, foreclosures, and the treatment of military personnel. For the first time, these banks face a watchdog dedicated to keeping them honest, Joseph A. Smith, North Carolina's ex-commissioner of banks. Previous guidelines, including those for the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP, that required speedy responses for customers, were ignored as banks lost paperwork or otherwise stalled applications. Five banks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial, agreed to the changes as part of the February deal to end federal and state probes into allegations they cut corners in foreclosing on the homes of thousands of customers. Servicing standards differ greatly from previous guidelines and require changes in operational systems. While HAMP was voluntary and could only withhold incentives, banks now faced up to $1 million per violation and up to $5 million for some repeat violations if a servicer isn't keeping to the deal. Banks now have 30 days to review a completed loan modification application under the settlement guidelines. Lengthy delays are one reason HAMP has helped only a fraction of the 3 million to 4 million homeowners originally set as the government's goal. The program has resulted in about 825,000 permanent modifications since 2009. Under the new guidelines, banks can't foreclose on a borrower's property if a modification has started, a process dubbed dual tracking. Servicers also must provide borrowers with a so-called single point of contact, a bank employee who can shepherd customers through the modification process. Regarding the other part of the February settlement, giving distressed homeowners a total of $20 billion in relief, banks finally may have incentive to act promptly. Loans modified within the first 12 months of the three-year program are worth 25% more in credits toward satisfying terms of the deal, meaning banks can reduce the debts of fewer homeowners by hitting targets early. The five banks have given about $10.6 billion in relief through June, mostly in the form of short sales, in which a delinquent borrower's home is sold for less than the amount owed. That results in fewer credits because servicers get less than 50 cents on the dollar for short sales. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. During the 224-year history of the United States, women have been allowed to vote in presidential elections in only 92 of those years, a mere 41%. Dr. Sandra Treadway, the librarian of Virginia, spoke on the history of women's suffrage at the Library of Virginia on October 3, 2012, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here are the first half of Dr. Treadway's remarks.
Now, for most of American history, women have had a subordinate status before the law. They were not considered equal to men in terms of political, economic, or legal rights. From the colonial period until well into the late 19th century, a single woman, no matter what her age, lived her life under the authority of a father or a male guardian until marriage. And then at that point, that authority transferred to her husband. Married women were restricted in what they could do outside the home and the influence that they had in society at large. They could not own property in their own right, and any property they might have controlled before they contracted their marriage legally became the property of their husbands. They couldn't sign legal documents, they couldn't act on their own behalf in business matters, and they had no recognized place in public life. They had little access to higher education and limited opportunities to earn a living beyond very domestic-related pursuit. Widows had a little bit more flexibility than married women. They lost their male protector, and often they had to bear the responsibility for children and taking care of children. So they were allowed to own property and manage and conduct their own affairs. A widow with means often thought twice about remarrying, as remaining single was the only way to have a degree of independence. Now, we don't know who among American women was the very first to voice a desire for that situation to change, especially as it related to legal or political rights. The person who's most often credited with first expressing this idea is Abigail Adams, who wrote to her husband John in 1776, just a few months before the Declaration of Independence was signed. She wrote to him, "By the way, this new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire that in it you remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and we will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Now, not many people know that a Virginia woman expressed similar sentiments about the same time. In 1778, Hannah Lee Corbin, who was a widow living in Westmoreland County, who just happened to be the sister of the revolutionary statesman Richard Henry Lee, indignantly wrote her brother a note. He was then serving as a member of the Continental Congress. And she complained that independent women, such as herself, suffered from taxation without representation, since they could not vote for the local officials who imposed taxes on them. If women were not to be granted political rights, she asserted to her brother, they should be exempt from paying property taxes. Well, Richard Henry Lee expressed sympathy with her position, but he didn't see how she could be excused from paying for government services through the taxation practice. He did, however, agree in principle with her contention that women should be able to vote for the local officials who levied those taxes. He did not, however, push that point in the Continental Congress or in the Virginia legislature, and the laws of the nation and the new Commonwealth of Virginia did not change. Now, with the rise of cities in America in the 1830s and the 1840s, middle and upper middle class women found themselves with new opportunities to join together to be part of a reform impulse that swept the nation in that period. Reformers, many of them encouraged by churches, and a lot of women got their start in any activity outside the home through their work in churches, began to address social problems that had become more pronounced in America with increased urbanization. Things like the hours and conditions of workers, urban poverty, the care of the disabled, temperance reform, public education, and the abolition of slavery. Women were drawn into this work and sometimes even founded voluntary associations devoted to social improvement. As women ventured outside the domestic sphere into the public realm, it wasn't long before the question of women's rights became part of this reform effort. Now, not all approved of women's involvement in activities outside the home. In fact, in 1840, the anti-slavery movement split over whether or not to allow women to speak in public and to actively serve the abolitionist cause. Two women who had been staunch advocates of anti-slavery and other reform endeavors became particularly frustrated by the limitations placed on their efforts and other reforms work that they did, and they wanted to call attention to this dilemma. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, a well-educated New York activist and mother of seven, how she had time for anything else is a wonder, and Lucretia Mott, a Philadelphia Quaker, issued a call to a meeting that would be open to anyone who wanted to come to talk about the social, civil, and religious condition and rights of women. More than 1,000 people responded to that call, gathering in a small town of Seneca Falls, New York, to listen to speakers, many of them women, describe their grievances. At the conclusion of what's now called the Seneca Falls Convention, the assemblage adopted a declaration of sentiments, summing up the rights they believed women should have. It was patterned on the Declaration of Independence, and their declaration proclaimed, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal." Now, this Declaration of Sentiments, when people actually read it, made them a little nervous. It went a little beyond what some people who turned out for the convention felt comfortable with. And some of the attendees even refused to sign the document. And for the next 20 years, the Seneca Falls Convention that kind of officially kicked off a women's rights movement in America, that movement grew very slowly. The leaders of the movement held annual conventions, and they lectured to anyone who would come and listen. But the effort suffered from a shortage of funds and a lack of responsiveness from the public at large. It was an idea before its time. Despite this, there were a few gains. One of these was the slow granting of property rights to women. In 1839, Mississippi became the first state to give married women their right to hold property. And by the 1860s, 11 more states had adopted similar laws. Virginia was one of the last states to pass a married woman's property law. It was not until 1876 that women could hold property in their own name in the Old Dominion. Now, another gain for women's rights in the pre-Civil War years was the amazing partnership that formed between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and temperance and civil rights reformer Susan B. Anthony. Stanton and Anthony became the face, the voice, and the conscience of the woman suffrage movement for the next 40 years. They were delighted at the end of the Civil War by passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery, and the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed citizenship to African Americans. But they and those interested in women's rights were very disappointed when the 15th Amendment guaranteed that the rights of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. It failed to mention voting rights for women.
You've been listening to Dr. Sandra Treadway, the Librarian of Virginia, speaking on the history of women's suffrage at the Library of Virginia on October 3rd, 2012. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of Dr. Sandra Treadway, the Librarian of Virginia, on the history of women's suffrage at a talk delivered at the Library of Virginia on October 3, 2012.
Reformers like Stanton and Anthony came to realize that women would never be in a position to effect change or secure any other rights without the power of the vote. So in 1869, Stanton and Anthony founded the National Woman Suffrage Association, the first national association devoted exclusively to accomplishing a woman's suffrage amendment added to the U.S. Constitution. Now, their effort in 1869 was far too radical for most Americans, especially in the South, where woman suffrage was seen as just another fanatical idea that outsiders wished to impose on the defeated South during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. Still, at least one intrepid Richmonder tried to spark interest in the suffrage cause in Virginia. Inspired by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, a Richmonder named Anna Boddicker drew a group of women together to a meeting in her home up on Church Hill to talk about forming a state chapter of the National Association. She wrote articles about women's rights in the local newspapers, and she sponsored visits to Richmond by all the prominent suffrage proponents, including Susan B. Anthony, who actually spent 3 days in Richmond talking and trying to win converts. And in 1871, when the National Woman Suffrage Association encouraged women just to assert their right to vote, to go down to the polls on election day and try to cast a ballot, Boddicker herself went down to the voting precinct in her area of town. And of course, she was denied the right to vote on the basis of her sex. But what she asked and got permission to do was to write on a piece of paper and stick it in the ballot box that she protested and that she believed she had the right to vote. A year later, Susan B. Anthony was actually arrested and fined for trying to vote in her district in a presidential election. Now, as the American nation grew and territories in the western United States became states, political leaders in those frontier areas were much more willing to grant women the right to vote. The territory of Wyoming, for example, which was organized in 1869, allowed women to vote in the territory, and when Wyoming became a state and was admitted to the Union in 1890, Wyoming became the first state with a constitution that allowed woman suffrage. Utah, Colorado, and Idaho followed suit. A constitutional amendment supporting woman suffrage was actually introduced for the first time in Congress in 1878. Now, it was soundly defeated, but that same amendment would be introduced every year in Congress, the same amendment for the next 41 years. Still, the movement pressed onward, but by the turn of the century, its leadership was starting to change. Elizabeth Cady Stanton died in 1902 and Susan B. Anthony in 1906. And a new generation of suffrage leaders that included women like Anna Howard Shaw and Carrie Chapman Catt on the national level led impressive and well-organized campaigns. And they shifted the strategy a bit for achieving women's suffrage. And they thought, trying to get a constitutional national amendment, they saw the challenges with that. So they encouraged the creation of strong state suffrage organizations to support their effort and thought maybe at the state level some changes could occur. So they focused on intensive lobbying work at the statewide and local level to persuade the American population state by state that woman suffrage was an idea that whose time had come. They persuaded and educated politicians, and they began to see progress. By the late 19-teens, most northern and Midwestern states allowed women to vote, at least in local or state elections. And some included presidential elections. Now, President Theodore Roosevelt's wife, Edith, and his daughter, Alice, were staunch supporters of women's suffrage, and they pressured him to take action. But he managed to sidestep that issue, as did his successor, William Howard Taft. But things began to look much more promising with the election of Woodrow Wilson as president in 1912. On the eve of Wilson's inauguration in what was then March, presidents used to be inaugurated in March, in 1913, 5,000 women gathered in Washington, D.C. They joined in a parade to protest yet another presidential election and inauguration that had excluded them. President Wilson soon realized that, unlike his predecessors, he could not easily ignore the suffrage cause. And one contributing factor in the shift in public opinion was the increasing number of women who were visible working outside the home. That number had grown exponentially. In 1880, there had been only 2.6 million women in the American labor force. By 1912, there were 8 million. With increasing numbers of women working in the many clerical and sales jobs that our industrial and consumer economy had created. And World War I only accelerated that growth. As 4 million men headed off to fight, women were encouraged to take their places in the workforce. And women also demonstrated tremendous patriotism by organizing war bond drives, conserving foodstuffs, and by volunteering for organizations like the Red Cross. Each day it became harder and harder to deny women's important contributions to American life and to continue to deny them the rights of full citizens. Women's impatience also grew, and while many suffragists refrained from marching and campaigning during the war years, some of them accelerated. They adopted picketing and civil disobedience tactics to drive their point home, and some were even arrested for this and imprisoned. By 1918, they had worn Woodrow Wilson down. Wilson publicly endorsed the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, as it was called, to the Constitution, and he asked Congress to pass it. "We have made partners of women in this war," he told Congress. "Shall we admit them only to a partnership of suffering and sacrifice and toil, and not to a partnership of right?" The amendment failed to pass in 1918, but it was reintroduced the following year, and by June of 1919, it passed both houses of Congress. Then the amendment went to the states for ratification, and one by one, the number of states in the pro-suffrage column began to grow. 36 states were needed to put the amendment over the top, and the honor of being the state that secured the vote for women fell to Tennessee. The debate in the Tennessee legislature on the question was fierce, and as the final vote was about to be taken, it appeared it would end in a tie of 48-48. Then at the last minute, a young Tennessee representative named Harry Byrne, and I kid you, this is a true story, kid you not, received a letter from his mother basically urging him to be a good boy and do the right thing and vote for the amendment. And he switched his vote. And on August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment became law, guaranteeing that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on the account of sex. But today, as we reflect on the long road that women have traveled in securing the right to vote, we should remember that there are still places in this world where women do not have this right, places where women are treated as property, where their freedom to choose what to wear, let alone to determine their own destiny, is severely curtailed. So as we look toward the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, the very best way that we can thank our grandmothers and great-grandmothers for fighting so hard for women's rightful place in American life is to be sure that we do exercise the right they won for us all against formidable odds and vote.
You've been listening to Dr. Sandra Treadway, the Librarian of Virginia, speaking on the history of women's suffrage at the Library of Virginia on October 3rd, 2012. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. In just 13 days, Virginians will be voting for president, a U.S. senator, and Congress. Would you know what to do if confronted with a voting problem or challenge on Election Day? If not, you won't want to miss next week's show when Claire Gastanaga, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia, enlightens us on our legal rights as voters. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.